Welcome to All Sides with Dan Fisher. He's known as Maka to his childhood friends. He became one of the lads from Liverpool, co-founder of the Beatles, and now he's Sir Paul McCartney. With his co-writer John Lennon on his own, he's written many of the great popular songs of the late 20th and this century. As famous as he is, he's often taken second place to the adulation for John Lennon as a rocker, songwriter, and humanitarian. We're going to take a look at Paul McCartney's life with biographer Howard Soons, author of Fab, An Intimate Life of Paul McCartney, where he came from, his amazing life, his incredible work ethic, and his second career as a solo performer. Welcome to the show, Howard.
Thank you, Anne.
This is a massive book. You sort of covered the waterfront. Was there anything you left out?
Oh, yes. I left a great deal out. The book was longer in the first draft. I mean, it's a long book because it's a big life.
Yeah.
That's the answer. This is a man who was in the Beatles, so that's a book in itself.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a whole other book about what happens after the Beatles. That's why it's 600 pages. And actually, that's not so long. You know, I've got a biography of Winston Churchill in my study that's 1,000 pages.
Right. There have been many biographies written. What was your goal with this? What did you want to achieve?
Well, I thought the structure was really important. I mean, that sounds like a boring subject.
Not to me.
The authors are very... It's very important to an author, the structure of a book. Books are like buildings. They have a frame and they have a design. And I thought that there was a fundamental problem with the design of previous biographies, because basically authors had got obsessed with Paul in the Beatles, naturally enough, and they had lost sight of the fact that there's a life beyond the Beatles. So almost all the biographies before mine run out of puff at about 1970. And that, I thought, was a fundamental flaw, and I could at least redress that.
In a way, though, if it had been done any sooner, it might have been too soon. You had an advantage to have some time go by since since the breakup of the Beatles, and of course, since the death of his wife, Linda.
Yeah, and I think basically people get more interesting as they get older. We all do.
Mm-hmm.
Lives become richer. A young man like Paul was in the 60s. He may be successful and handsome and all the rest of it, but he hasn't experienced fatherhood and bereavement and grief and failure and aging. The whole aging process makes people interesting. And the whole point of biography is to tell an interesting story of an interesting life. So the older people get, the better the subject is.
I enjoyed reading about his family. They had a big influence on him. And can you tell us about them? The death of his mother was a big blow.
Yeah, yes. The story is fairly well known.
Mm-hmm.
He's a working class boy from Liverpool, very close, happy, intelligent, musical, friendly family, and had a very happy childhood, unlike John. But when he was 14, his mother died of cancer, and of course that was a great blow.
614-292-8513. If you'd like to give us a call and join the conversation, my guest is Howard Soons. He's the author, biographer of Paul McCartney. The name of the book, Fab, An Intimate Life of Paul McCartney. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Let's hear one of the Beatles' first songs, one of the first Beatles songs written by Paul McCartney and released in 1963. The first line, "She was just 17, you know what I mean," has become iconic, captures the happy early days of Beatlemania. That is I Saw Her Standing There from 1963 from the Please Please Me album. You don't fawn over Paul McCartney and his songwriting skills.
Well, no, I don't. I mean, I think it's important that biographers stand apart from their subjects. You can't be too much in love with your subject. You have to be objective and professional. And praise good work and criticize bad work. I mean, that's part of the job of a biographer.
What do you think his heyday was as a songwriter?
Well, I mean, absolutely without a doubt, everybody in the world knows that he was a, you know, the Beatles were great, were fabulous. That's why the books are called Fab. Mm-hmm. They're fabulous. They were the Fab Four. And Paul was a very large part of that success. I mean, he co-wrote or wrote alone many of their very best songs. But after the Beatles, there is a distinct, sharp falling off in quality. So clearly, the unique cocktail that was the Beatles was he couldn't do it alone. Now, he's written good songs afterwards. He's made some interesting music. I'm not saying it's all rubbish, mm-hmm. but there is, generally speaking, a distinct falling off in quality after 1970.
Do you what inspired you to do the biography now? You spent 2 years researching it. I don't know how long you spent actually writing it, but why now? What and why him? You've done others.
The reasons are partly in personal interest, partly commercial. He's one of the most famous people in the world, and this book is published mm-hmm. all over the world. And one makes a living writing these books. So if you write about people who are too obscure, you don't sell that many books. So that's part of it. I find him personally interesting. I think he's a more interesting person, a more nuanced person than people often think. He's not just the smiley face in the magazine making the peace sign. There's a toughness there, which actually I quite admire. You don't get to be Sir Paul McCartney, a dollar billionaire, by being, you know, a sappy, nice guy. He's a tough, ruthless, ambitious, very hardworking man. And also, you know, the second marriage, the fiasco of the second marriage, which happened around the time I was planning the book, that really helps a biographer because it's an interesting story and Heather is an interesting person. And what you need for a biography is interesting stuff happening, not just another tour, another album, another tour, another album. Interesting personal stuff is important as well. There has to be a mixture of the personal and the professional. And that disastrous second marriage makes a very interesting ending for the book.
It was so public. How much in the book wasn't in People magazine?
Well, I don't know what was in People magazine, but inevitably there's only a certain amount of space in the popular press for detail. Mm-hmm. And the great luxury you have as a writer is that you have the space to explore the facts. And so you will have read some of the stuff about the headlines, as it were, about the divorce before in the press. But it's not all about headlines. It's about the detail and the nuance. And when you read the detail, I think it's actually still a very surprising story. And I think the point is that the reader develops a greater understanding of Paul and Heather and the situation.
Let's hear another cut. This one is, I guess, illustrates how the Beatles matured as artists working with producer George Martin. Here's Paul McCartney's song, I'm Looking Through You. It's from the Rubber Soul album in 1965.
I'm looking through you. Where did you go? I thought I knew you. What did I know? You don't look different, but you have changed. I'm looking through you. You're not the same.
Love that. That the directness in the writing. Simplicity.
One of his better early lyrics, I think. And, of course, it relates directly to his personal life, to his relationship with Jane Asher, mm-hmm. the English actress who was the first significant woman in his life, really. Not a rather tempestuous relationship, an open relationship in true 60s style. And yet, of course, free love isn't free, and there was jealousy, and I'm looking through you and all the rest of it, that there were rows. And there was jealousy, and that's what that song's about.
Did he, as he grew, did his music become more personal in that way before, you know, maybe She Was Just 17, or I Saw Her Standing There, it was pop, much more pop, more generalized. This did seem more personal, I'm Looking Through You.
Yes, well, to a point, Lord Copper, he became more personal in the mid-60s, around the time of the track you just played. Mm-hmm. and towards the end of the Beatles experiment or the Beatles project. But then it seems to me that he rode back from that in his solo career in the 40 years since the Beatles. I mean, it's 40 years now. Mm-hmm. In all those years since the Beatles, he's been very reluctant to be personal. Very few of the songs are directly autobiographical. And certainly he, unlike great American songwriters like Bob Dylan and Canadian songwriters, Joni Mitchell, Leonard Cohen, the really great songwriters of our time, he's not introspective, generally speaking. He doesn't reveal a great deal of himself in his songs. And actually, I think that's a flaw, because the songs, as a result, often aren't as compelling.
614-292-8513. You can call that number and speak with my guest, Howard Soons, author and biographer of Paul McCartney. The name of the book is Fab, An Intimate Life of Paul McCartney. It's just out. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. How did you decide how much music you were actually going to talk about versus his life?
Well, it's always a balance. I think some people criticize a biography like this by saying, oh, well, there's not enough about the music in it. But I think they forget that biography is about a life. Primarily, it's about a life. And to my mind, it should be a balance of the life and the work. So, for instance, if I was to write a biography of Mark Twain, I would like, obviously, have to write about all of Mark Twain's writings. But it is just as important. It would be inexcusable not to address Mark Twain, the man, the husband, the son, the businessman. The personal life is absolutely vital. And so there has to be a balance of the two. And if you just write about music, you know, you're not writing biography. A great deal of music books or music biographies are just really encyclopedias of facts, you know, tour dates, album tracks, album listings, and song analysis. Often it can be rather immature song analysis. It's the sort of stuff that college boys would write. And I find that rather dreary. I want a biography to be a life. And in a biography, the character, in this book, Sir Paul McCartney, should be like a character in a novel. He should be an interesting person whose life has a plot and it develops throughout the course of the book. Now, you have to adhere strictly to the facts of his life. You mustn't make things up, of course. But you should be able to tell the story in such a way that the reader wants to turn the pages and find out what happens next. That's the trick of writing biography.
All righty, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. My guest is Howard Soons, author of Fab, An Intimate Life of Paul McCartney. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Say Lawrence of Arabia, and the image that shimmers to mind is Peter O'Toole in Arab robes leading the Bedouin to Aqaba and on to Damascus. But T.E. Lawrence was far more than the man on the movie screen. He was a military genius who led a war of liberation and redrew the map of the Middle East. I'm Neil Conan, Michael Korda on his new biography, Hero. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And Talk of the Nation begins at 2 o'clock right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Hear more from WOSU anytime at WOSU.org. Listen to All Sides with Ann Fisher whenever you want with the online archive. Podcast new and archive shows from all the guests and topics. Podcast All Sides at WOSU.org/allsides. Cloudy skies today, a slight chance of rain off and on throughout the day, a high of 45 degrees. The low tonight, 28 degrees with cloudy skies. Sunshine tomorrow, a high of 52. All Sides continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Up the rice in the church where a wedding has been. Lives in a dream, waits at the window, wearing the face that she keeps in a jar by the door.
Welcome back. It's All Sides with Dan Fisher. My guest is Howard Soons, author of Fab, An Intimate Life of Paul McCartney. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call, 614-292-8513. That was Eleanor Rigby by Paul McCartney from the 1966 Revolver album. Not only beautiful music, but some of his best lyrics. I was interested in the story, and it may be not maybe well-known story, Howard, but about how that line, Eleanor Rigby picks up the rice in the church where the wedding has been, just came to him.
Yeah, I must say I've forgotten because it's a while since I wrote the book, but you probably know better than I do.
Just the process of it, and that even he was stunned by that. But it was from that same period as I'm looking through you, somewhat dark.
Yes. One of his best lyrics, mm-hmm. I think. Really one of his best lyrics. And, of course, there is this remarkable coincidence that Eleanor Rigby, yeah. This invented character, he thought he invented this name. It turns out that there is a real Eleanor Rigby buried in the church yard grounds where Paul met John when they were teenagers. So it's a really, of course, it's a very unusual name. That's quite a striking coincidence.
Yeah, he said that he didn't know if that was what influenced him or not, maybe subconsciously.
Yeah. But it's really quite strange. If you go there now, if you go to Liverpool and you go to this church, this old English churchyard, and there is this Victorian graveyard. And I'm not sure if it's Victorian, maybe Edwardian. But anyway, there is Eleanor Rigby still there with the grass growing around her stone. Quite spooky.
His relationship with John changed after the band broke up. But they reunited when John Lennon was in L.A. when he was estranged from Yoko Ono, and it was they kind of reconnected there. I think Ringo Starr showed up too.
Paul called in on John when he was recording in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. Yes, and they had a sort of reconciliation. But I think essentially the friendship was broken in the Beatles, and it was never. They were never really close again. I think, of course, they're very different people. Paul is an outgoing, friendly person, and he is to this day. He likes people. And I think John was a more doer, as the Scottish say, a more doer, closed-in person. And, of course, you can see why that is, because of his difficult childhood. I mean, perhaps a more suspicious, a less trusting person. And I think he got to a stage in his life where he'd had enough of Paul McCartney and he didn't have much use for him anymore. And that, of course, hurt Paul terribly because it was really, I'm sure the Beatles would be going to this day, like the Rolling Stones, if John and Paul hadn't fallen out.
Brian, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks, Dan. I just wanted to ask Mr. Soons if he could glean from his research how much impact the experimentation with, let's just say, mind-altering substances may have had on the writing of some of these songs?
Well, I think a great deal, and of course there's no reason to be coy about it. I mean, Paul is completely open about his use of drugs over the years. He's unapologetic. He's a 60s guy. He's the quintessential 60s guy, and he's been smoking pot since Bob Dylan turned him on. And, of course, that did change everything, didn't it? I mean, that changed the lyrics they wrote. And, of course, LSD was a major factor in all their lives, and they all admit that.
Right. Well, that's I happen to be a songwriter myself, but I haven't gone down that road. I just wonder where I might have gone had I chosen that avenue.
Yeah,
but I don't think I'll do that.
No, I met a friend when I was doing the book. I interviewed a friend of Paul's who'd had some very bad LSD experiences, some really nightmarish ones. And I said, you know, I've never taken LSD. Would you recommend it? And he said, yeah, it changed my life, man. And I looked at this guy and I thought, I don't really want to have my life changed quite as much as that because he looked terrible.
Thanks, Brian, for your call. Take care. This is an email from Robin. She wants to know if you spent time with Paul McCartney and writing the biography, and my understanding is Paul did not help you with this.
No. The first person I wrote to was him, saying, I'm going to write this book, and what do you think, and will you speak to me? And he said no, he hadn't got the time. And he And that's only to be expected, of course. I did meet him, and I met, of course, hundreds of people that know him. So, but essentially, one has to work around the subject and investigate the life like a detective would. That's the process if you write unauthorized biography. I sometimes think people think unauthorized biographies are not as good as authorized biographies, but I would argue vehemently against that because, of course, they are independent. You're not in the pocket of the subject. You can tell the truth. And a great deal of authorized biographies, whereby the star pays a hack writer to do their bidding, to write their story, they're very partial. They're not often very honest. They're less vigorously researched.
How difficult in this case was it to get people to not only do interviews with you, but to really open up and tell you the stories? Because there's so much detail in the book. It's amazing some of the detail you have in there.
Yeah, well, detail makes a book, doesn't it? Well, some people are very difficult. Some people won't talk at all, of course, and therefore they don't really appear. Some people are always, I think, surprisingly indiscreet. And what you really want as a biographer is indiscreet interviewees, people who say, who just talk and talk and talk. One of the funniest, I thought, in this book was Paul's uncle Mike, who's sprinkled throughout the book and is a very amusing Liverpool character in show business, actually, an old variety artist, rather like vaudeville in America. Mm-hmm. And he's very funny and very indiscreet and candid about Paul, and very affectionate too, but funny. And that's always good for a biography.
Have you received any feedback about from Paul or from his family?
No, I haven't. And I wouldn't expect to unless mm-hmm. there was something that I got terribly wrong. And, of course, I've worked very, very hard to make sure I don't get things wrong. And that's part of the point of writing unauthorized biography. You have to be very, very careful, very scrupulous with your facts, because you don't want to get sued. And so the facts are very, very carefully checked, and hopefully the thing is absolutely solid.
Let's listen to Hey Jude. It is the first single I ever bought. It's one of Paul's most popular songs. It's from 1968.
Hey Jude.
That, of course, is the song Hey Jude, one of Paul McCartney's most popular. It was written about Julian Lennon.
Yeah, because, of course, John Lennon behaved rather badly, didn't he? He abandoned Cynthia and his son to go off with Yoko. And Paul felt sorry for them, went round there and wrote this song to sort of comfort Julian, because it was Jules, Hey Jules, J-U-L-E-S. That was the original lyric, mm-hmm. and then he changed it to Jude. By admitting that it's the first record you bought, of course, you age yourself.
Yes, I do. I do that every once in a while just to toy with people. Yeah.
The first record I ever bought was probably last year or something like that.
You're a real spring chicken there.
Yeah.
I've always wondered about that song. He wrote it about Julian. Did that offend John Lennon?
Well, no. I'd rather... Madly, John Lennon saw it as a compliment.
Okay.
I think he misread the lyric to be when the lyric about go out and get that part of the song. John interpreted this to mean that Paul meant, yes, go and have your fling with Yoko. Yes, leave your wife, abandon your family.
It
go
was giving him Yoko. Permission. Okay.
So, of course, John completely egotistically and, of course, befuddled by drugs and ego, as he was at that stage in his life, mm-hmm. he took this to mean quite the opposite. It didn't seem to dawn upon him that he'd abandoned his wife and child. And of course, he actually behaved very badly. You know, he, in contrast to Paul, who, whatever one might say about him, has been an exemplary father and husband in his first marriage, certainly, and indeed in his second marriage, because he had a child with Heather, exemplary father. John was a pretty lousy father to Julian.
What was Paul, how did Paul take John's death?
Well, pretty hard, I think. He said casually, here in London, I'm speaking to you from London, it's a drag, because he was caught by the press outside a recording studio. But I suppose he was simply caught off guard. Mm-hmm. And of course it was a great shock, wasn't it? How could it not be? John was his best friend from childhood, his best mate, the boy. They'd been friends since boyhood. And they had had this great adventure together. So how could it not be devastating?
We have an email from Debbie. She asks, did Paul really teach Elvis over the phone how to play the bass guitar? That was an interesting meeting that you described, Howard, in the book.
Yes. Yes, over the phone is a different incident. Yes, I think that is correct. But, okay. Of course, they met famously. They met in Bel Air in L.A. I think it was a slightly anticlimactic meeting because, mm-hmm. of course, the Beatles grew up. I think this is an interesting point. Of course, the Beatles grew up in post-war England, absolutely in love with American culture, American music and movies. And Elvis, to them, was a kind of a god. But really, it was the Elvis pre the army. The post-army Elvis, who appeared in all those terrible films, was a great letdown for them. And that, of course, was the Elvis whom they met. They met Elvis, who made those movies in Hawaii, and they were rather contemptuous of that.
The part of the book that I sort of rushed to was about his marriage, and he had a wonderful marriage with Linda.
Yeah.
Let's listen to a song inspired by her. The breakup of the Beatles was difficult for everybody, but as you mentioned earlier, especially Paul, he lost his songwriting partner and began drinking heavily. His wife, Linda, encouraged him to start writing and performing again. Maybe I'm Amazed as a song about his love for his wife, Linda, on his debut solo album for McCartney in 1970.
Baby, I'm amazed the way you love me all the time. Maybe I'm afraid of the way I love you. Baby, I'm amazed the way you
That song kind of gives me chills.
Yeah, me too. It's great, isn't it?
Yes.
I think the lyric is perhaps not quite finished, but it's certainly got a great, there's a swelling of emotion there, which is one of his best songs, I think.
When Linda had cancer, she was sick for a long time, struggled with it, and you somehow got that story of their last days together.
Well, yes. I mean, I've pieced that together from a variety of sources. She died in Arizona. They had a ranch. They have a ranch in Arizona, mm-hmm. near Tucson. He has the key part of the story, the most moving part of the story. He tells himself. This is the story about how he got into bed with her, held her hand, and he spoke to her about imagining they were back in England riding their horses through the Bluebell Woods in England. And as which was a favorite thing that they did together. And as he told her that story, she died, literally almost in his arms. And, of course, it's impossible not to be moved by that. It was the end of a long, happy marriage. They produced a family together. They'd been best of friends, lovers, spouses for many years. And, of course, now this part of his life was over. And it comes about two-thirds of the way into the book. Mm-hmm. After which, of course, we have the fiasco of the second marriage. But the first marriage, the ending of the first marriage, is really very poignant, and I think one feels a great deal of sympathy for him.
I made me think about this when I was reading about how soon after Linda died, and it wasn't that soon, but it was relatively soon that Heather Mills caught his eye. And not long after that, they were married, and it made me wonder about he really liked being in a relationship. It made me think about that, about him in that way.
Yes, I think that's right. And, of course, he wouldn't be the first middle-aged man who's lost a wife, been widowed, and has rushed into a second marriage too hastily. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's typical behavior. And if you're Paul McCartney, there's no shortage of women wanting to be your wife.
After Linda, though, he wasn't a philanderer.
No, quite, yes. Indeed, I think he certainly was a philanderer in his youth, in his 20s, in the Beatles. But I think when he met Linda, he realized that he saw the value of a stable, monogamous relationship. I mean, he really loved being married. He loved being a dad. He was a great dad. They took the kids everywhere with them. And I think when Linda died, he wanted that again, really. He wanted another stable, monogamous relationship. But I think he felt sorry for Heather. You know, she's got one leg. She is disabled. And in fact, she's coped with that quite bravely. She's a very strong character. And I think the Beatles tend to gravitate towards strong women. And she certainly is a strong character. And she is a very attractive, or she certainly was, going back a few years, she was a very attractive woman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very. You mentioned that they were gravitated towards strong women. Why do you think that is? Because
I agree. I think it's a very interesting point. It's certainly true, isn't it, of all the Beatles, really. Mm-hmm. And it surely must be because they are themselves so wealthy, famous, and powerful because of their position in life that most people are rather overawed by them. And only the strongest women, people like Yoko and Linda and Heather, can kind of cut through that that nonsense and actually make a connection. Most people would sort of fawn over them. But Yoko, of course, very strong person in her own right, she cut through all that and kind of grabbed John and said, look, you know, it's you and me now, mate. And most people wouldn't have had the the chutzpah to be so confident with a Beatle.
You spent 2 years and did 250 interviews, I think, to produce this book. Was there anything that really surprised you?
Yes, quite a few things, I suppose. Probably a feeling more than anything that at the end of the book that I felt sorry for him, because the book does end around about the time of the second marriage and the aftermath. Mm-hmm. And if you read those last two or three chapters, I think you do feel sorry for him in relation to Heather. It was certainly an ill-judged marriage. And it cost him, not so much in money terms, the money is irrelevant, he's so rich, the money is neither here nor there, mm-hmm. but it cost him, it was embarrassing, and it was really a mess. And it must have been emotionally draining. And the whole thing was really, it wasn't how you'd expect your life to be at that age. If you were Paul McCartney, when I'm 64, you know, that wasn't what he ended up, what he thought he would be at 64.
Do you think he's happy now?
I hope he is. I think so. I think he's a happy person by disposition. Mm-hmm. He's a sunny, you see that whenever you see him perform. He is a sunny person. He's got this lady now who's very similar character to Linda. She's a New Yorker. Right. Her dad's a self-made immigrant millionaire. She's Jewish. She lives just a couple of blocks from where Linda lived when he met Linda. Attractive woman. I think, crucially, this new girlfriend, Nancy, she knows not to try to overshadow her partner. She stands in the background. And I think one of Heather's key mistakes was she thought she was as famous as Paul McCartney. And you're never going to be as famous as Paul McCartney.
Well, you should know. That's Howard Soons. He's author of Fab, An Intimate Life of Paul McCartney. It's out now. Howard, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Anne.
Enjoyed the conversation. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
In 1936, George VI took the throne of England after his brother abdicated. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Tom Hooper, director of the new film, The King's Speech.
So you have this guy who has no expectation of being king. He has a terrible stammer and becomes king, you know, and he can't speak.
The film tells the story of the king's relationship with his unconventional speech therapist. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Join WOSU Public Media and the Refectory for a Chefs in the City wine tasting. Tomorrow at 5:30, guests will sample hand-selected wines and taste exclusive creations by Chef Richard Blondon. You'll also be a part of a special WOSU TV production. A limited number of tickets are on sale now. Visit WOSU.org/chefs. That's WOSU.org/chefs. 41 degrees in downtown Columbus with some light rain, a slight chance of rain off and on throughout the day today, a high of 45. And partly cloudy skies tonight, a low of 28 degrees. Sunshine and clear skies tomorrow, a high of 52. Looking ahead to Saturday, some clouds return, but no real threat of rain for Saturday, and a high of 51. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. That was Make Love, Not War, from John Lennon's fourth post-Beatles solo album on October 9th. It would have been John Lennon's 70th birthday. 20,000 people showed up in New York City's Central Park that day recently to watch an early screening of the documentary film Lennon NYC. The much-acclaimed American Masters film will now air on WOSU-TV Monday, November 22nd at 9 p.m. We've invited to the show documentary filmmaker Michael Epstein, who directed and produced Lennon NYC. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Good morning. Thank you. Nice to be here.
It will mark the 30th anniversary of John Lennon's death. Resonates with many people in the same way as, I guess, the assassinations of John F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King. He was a great life force, and that really comes out in the film.
It's amazing that it's been 30 years, hasn't it? Mm. I mean, it feels at once that we haven't had him for a very long time, and yet that he's still very much a part of our lives. So, you know, John is, I think, in the pantheon of artists and activists, in many ways, utterly unique. And hopefully that comes across in the documentary.
It does. I liked how you used the graphic approach you took with it, the outlining technique.
That was a happy accident, to be quite honest.
It's hard to describe. Can you describe to the listeners exactly what I'm
sure.
Awkwardly talking about?
Well, you know, maybe the best way to do it is to talk a little bit about the process. I'm a Lennon fan and a Beatle fan, I think, like a few other people out there. And I knew that there was some Lennon fatigue that I was going to be fighting making this documentary. The notion, like, what is there left to say? What is there left that I haven't already heard? And in trying to answer that creative question, we stumbled into all of these studio recordings of John during the making of Double Fantasy. Jack Douglas, who was the producer of Double Fantasy and is in the documentary, mm-hmm. Put microphones all over the Hit Factory in the summer of 1980 just to record literally everything that happened while they were. And we stumbled onto these recordings, and the first one I heard was something from the very first day where John's ordering dinner. And he's ordering sushi from a place called Kicho on West 45th Street in Manhattan. And I just fell in love with it because it was a John Lennon you've never, ever heard before. And
I love it when he says, tell him it's Yoko.
Tell him it's for her. Yeah, tell him it's for Yoko, because if it's for me, I'll never get it. And, you know, he's just stepping out. He's not rushing. And there's all of these, like, phenomenal quips and asides. And it answered a couple of questions, one which was, what was John's state of mind? Because there's a lot of ugly rumor that had been setting around that John was still very much on drugs, that he was really under Yoko's thumb at this point. He wasn't very happy. And you listen to this just, I mean, hours and hours. I mean, basically, Jack never turned the tape off. And you hear a very happy, very content John who is absolutely, completely in control of his art at that moment. And so I knew that was going to become the voice of the film, and I needed to go back in and do that for Elephant's Memory when he's recording sometime in New York City. I needed to do that for Walls and Bridges and for the Phil Spector sessions, which are crazy, mm-hmm. For the rock and roll album. The problem was that none of those things were visual, and I don't know if you've heard, but television has a visual component to it, unlike radio, and I thought, oh, my God, what am I going to do here? Mm-hmm. And so the first thing we did was we went back to photographers who had been a part of those sessions, Bob Gruen being an important one, David Spindell, Alan Tannenbaum, all who said, here's our archive. Here's every photo we took. Here are the negatives. Here are the contact sheets. You know, we licensed all of that from them, but we went back in and printed photographs that had never been printed before because they weren't the selects. And that was the start, but we then needed to kind of create some kind of cohesion that would connect all of that together. And that was really Brian Oakes, who was the director of graphic design for the documentary, who came up with this notion of kind of these lines that just kind of undulated and moved around and helped you connect all these different pieces. There were insert, I went in back into to the Hit Factory and took photographs myself of the same mixing board that they used and the same drum kit and the microphones. And we connected all of these various pictures together. And I don't know, maybe a month or so before we were finished with the documentary, I realized that all of these little line drawings sort of echoed John's drawings. Mm-hmm. And I wish I could say that that was the design from the front end, but it was just the happy accident. And I thought, oh, my God. You know, it was like that moment that we outlined John's glasses.
It, you know, it also gave me the impression of someone sort of doodling, and I definitely envision him as a doodler.
Well, he was. I mean, he was constantly doodling. I mean, you know, you see his postcards that he sent home to friends. You know, they're not long treatises. He was not an essayist, but he would send the funniest pictures, these doodles, that would tell a story. And that's what we tried to do. We did that also. Obviously, we knew we had to do that with a piece later in the film when John's sort of retired and he's just in the Dakota, and we have this remarkable home audio of Sean and him just drawing together, the smoking letter A.
Here's and a lot of that has been licensed now. It's, I don't know if they're still producing things with his doodles on them, but
yeah,
they did for a period there.
They're everywhere.
Yeah. Here's a clip from the documentary, Lennon NYC. It's a happy time in John's life. It's the time we were talking about earlier, the later in his life, when he's enjoying a walk in Central Park with Yoko, and he talks about the freedom he feels living in New York City.
One of my biggest kicks is just going out to eat or going to movies, you know, and doing things I couldn't do when I was, you know, in the middle of the Beatles stuff. And I really get off on that. And occasionally people ask for autograph or just want to shake hands is the coolest one that happens, which is cool with me. And I'm just known enough to keep my ego floating, but unknown enough to get around, which is nice.
Okay. I've been a follower of you for a long time.
Thank you.
My ego afloat.
Yeah, he was aware of that. He knew he needed that. But he loved the anonymity. He loved New York City. Both he and Yoko loved it.
Well, you know, there are a lot of components to that. I think, first of all, it's Yoko's city. She went to Sarah Lawrence College, and she was part of the Fluxus art movement in the 50s. And so she had a lot of her contemporary friends, Charlotte Moonen and Andy Warhol and all of those people that John adored. He loved being a part of that world. So when they came to New York in 71, they tapped right into that art scene, and he was very invigorated and excited by it. It was also a political center when he came. But for John, he often talked about not just that it was Rome, and so he wanted to be at the center of Rome, but it was reminiscent for him of Liverpool in a way that London was not. And I think that that was terribly important for him as well. You know, Liverpool and New York have this connection. The Cunard liner all through the 40s and 50s left Liverpool and docked in New York. And so John, throughout his entire childhood, would have what they called these Cunard Yanks, which were the guys that worked the liners and would come back from New York with things like blue jeans and crepe-soled shoes and T-shirts, and most importantly, American rock and roll. And that's, you know, that was a big part of the Mersey Beat that was important for all of the Beatles, the records that came off of those Cunard liners from New York City. And so there were the docks not too far from the Bank Street apartment when they moved in. There were this sort of polyglot taxi, you know, immigrant world. And it just felt to him like sort of an echo, if you will, of Liverpool. And he knew his dad had hung out quite a bit in New York as well. But I think the big thing was New York is the kind of place where nobody really cares if you're a celebrity. You know, that's still my taxi, and I still need to get to someplace right now.
Right.
So I don't care if you're John Lennon. That's my taxi. And I think he just thrived on that. I mean, you know, he Bob Gruen, who is a photographer and was a dear friend of John's, tells the story of them walking down the street, getting to a red light, and John just kind of sitting and waiting at the corner for the light to change, and a woman standing next to John, just sort of casually looking at him because, you know, just wanted to see who's standing next to you, and then doing a double take and realizing, oh, my God, it's John Lennon. And she got ready to scream, and John just put his finger up to his lips, like, shh, you know, it's okay. Don't worry about it. And they crossed the street, and then they went on their own way, and that was it. And I think, as he said, you know, it was enough that he was recognized, but not so much that he was accosted. You know, there's a story that is told in the film about him buying a jacket at a place called Charivari.
Yeah.
And it's just great. It's a remarkably funny story that Jack Douglas tells. But the essence of it is that he could go into a store, he could try clothes on, he could pay for it and leave. And that simple, ordinary experience was extraordinary for him, and he loved it.
I know he had dark times. Obviously, everybody knows that about him. And he struggled with drugs and alcohol a lot, particularly when he was in L.A., separated from Yoko Ono. But he had a wonderful sense of humor, too, that comes out in the film.
He is easily one of the funniest, wittiest people I've ever had the pleasure of spending time with in audio. You know, I mean, I never met him, but it's one thing to have people say, oh, he's very funny or he was really witty, but it's another thing to actually be able to hear it. And I don't know how much your listeners will be offended, but one of my favorite moments is when he's on WNEW, which was a big rock station, album-oriented rock station in the 70s, and he did a radio. He guest DJed for 2 hours with a gentleman named Dennis Elsis,
right.
And they talk about how he, you know, just maybe, you know, he loves New York and he wants to stay in New York, and, you know, maybe they just ban him from Ohio.
Yeah. I did jot that down in my notes, Michael.
Yes. Poor Ohio.
Well, he said he was nothing against Ohio.
Yes, exactly. We love Ohio.
It was just the first thing that came to mind, apparently.
Yeah.
He was funny, but he was more than funny. I guess, you know, there's funny and then there's the funny that's the kind and gentle, and he was friendly to people. He liked people. He didn't mind people liking him and strangers coming up to him.
He enjoyed all of that. I think he liked his privacy. I think that there was in England a sense of just the kind of anger and vitriol towards Yoko that seemed to him way out of proportion.
Yeah, they definitely sounded like exiles the way they described their decision to move back to New York together.
Right, and he didn't experience that with New Yorkers. Nobody really cared very much, and I think he always loved that. I think that it was, you know, he came and he was on Dick Cavett, he was on Mike Douglas. He felt that Yoko was accepted in a way that she never was going to be in the UK, and I think he was right. You know, you got to be much stranger than Yoko Ono to really get our hackles up in New York.
How did you decide to focus the film on Lennon's life in New York City during the 1970s and focus on that point, you know, which included his whole anti-war, his participation in the anti-war movement and of course, Yoko Ono, but how did you decide to kind of go there?
Why
with
New
this?
York? Yeah. Well, you know, to be honest, I don't think I ever saw John any other way. I mean, think of John, I think of Liverpool and maybe Hamburg, and then the Beatles are kind of everywhere. You know, if anything, they're Abbey Road. But post-Beatles, John's a New Yorker. He came here in 71. He took many trips in 1970, and I just always saw him as a New Yorker. You know, people still go to the Dakota all the time, and, you know, there's Strawberry Field on Central Park. And he hung out at the Cafe La Fortuna. He just was a New Yorker. He recorded almost all of his post-Beatle music here, even mixing things like Imagine in New York City. And I knew that his 70th birthday was this year and that it was also the 30th anniversary. It's a strange way to say it, anniversary, but
yeah,
the 30th, 30 years since he had been murdered. And I have a very lovely, strong working relationship with Susan Lacey, who's the executive producer of American Masters, and we were having coffee and trying to figure out what we wanted to do again, and I said, you know, let's do John. Let's do John Lennon. And she laughed, and she said, this is American Masters, what do you, you know, he's kind of a Beatle. He's kind of British. And I said, no, he's a New Yorker. Mm-hmm. This is an immigrant story.
Right.
And so, you know, for want of anything else, it was my desire to be part of American Masters again. I'd made a couple films for them. So it's a little bit of a trick, but I do think John becomes an American. And I think what's also really important is the thing that propels him And Keith Richards, if you read the new Keith Richards biography, autobiography, propels McCartney forward is American rock and roll. And so American rock and roll as an art form is definitive for them in the late 50s. And it's where John, sort of the second chapter of John's life happens. So New York just seemed right, and everything fit. Once you use New York as your lens, you can do the activism, you can do the music, and you can do the human being, the house husband. So, you know, you didn't have to choose the John Lennon you wanted to tell.
Let's listen to a song from the last album released by John Lennon and Yoko Ono before John's death.
Close your eyes, have no fear. The monster's gone, he's on the run, and your daddy's here. Beautiful, 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 beautiful boy.
That, of course, is a song that he wrote about and for his son, Sean, the son he had with Yoko Ono. But it sounds almost autobiographical, too.
Oh, that's an interesting take. I think, you know, John, in having Sean, in taking time away from rock and roll, mm-hmm. in just becoming a human being, as it were, and being a house husband, at a time when very few people were making that lifestyle choice. Mm-hmm. Now it's everywhere. I think he found redemption, and I think that's where where his story, at least it's a happy-ish ending. I mean, you obviously would rather have him with us, mm-hmm. and that part is terribly sad and tragic. But John found peace in Sean and Yoko and having a family. And I think that you hear echoes of what he didn't have with his mom, with Julia. You know, I was listening to you earlier with your prior guest talking about strong women in the Beatles.
Right.
You know, John's mom and his aunt, in fact, that whole wing of his family, the Baird sisters, all John ever knew growing up was strong women. You know, he had his uncle George, who was there with him as well. But John only ever knew strong women in his family. And so I think in that regard, Yoko was somebody who was very, very familiar to him, somebody who I think in a lot of ways mixed the best of Mimi and the best of Julia. She was both creative and strong in a way that his first wife, Cynthia, simply was not.
Michael Epstein, thanks for joining us.
It was a pleasure.
Michael Epstein is the filmmaker, documentary filmmaker of Lennon NYC. It will be aired on WOSU television on Monday night at 9 p.m. Check it out. It's a wonderful film. Thanks for joining us today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News.